So we spun out about 2 years ago from UCSF and we went really far. We moved across the street, literally like 50 feet, and raised some proper funds from Founders Fund and Lux. We've got kind of our platform set up now. We spent the first two years kind of in stealth. We knew that there were going to be a lot of fast follows since this was going to be pretty big first, right? The first AAV gene therapy in oncology and the first universal gene therapies.
Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of the Venture Europe podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Nicole Polk, the CEO and founder of the viral gene therapy startup Siren Biotechnology. Prior to being a founder, she was a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at UCSF in San Francisco, California, where her lab worked at the forefront of developing and engineering enabling technologies to make viruses better medicines. During this episode, we discuss the evolution of modern medicine from ingesting medicinal leaves to gene therapy. We also discuss how she plans to use viruses to treat cancer, and we discuss how therapies for sleeping only 4 hours are closer than you think. Enjoy. So just maybe to give the audience a little bit of background, I saw you the first time at the All In Summit, and I must say that your speech was the best. Even though we had Ray Dalio on the stage, we had Tobias from Shopify, Larry Summers, and I just tried to figure out like why. So I was kind of thinking to myself why your speech was just so impactful. And I think it was because I was not aware of the evolution of medicine, and I was not aware what one can do with gene therapy today. So I was kind of wondering if we can just start with a primer. How did we start and what is the state of the art now in modern medicine?
Yeah, and don't worry, a lot of folks still haven't heard of what gene therapy is. This is a very common kind of common surprise that people feel. So a good primer on like where we start, where are we at now, and where are we going? So for the most part, all medicines, right? All the things that all of us take, you know, when you go to your local pharmacy, when you go to the grocery store and you're picking up medicine, little in pill format, right? These are chemical drugs. And this is really kind of where the first era of modern medicine began. This is when we realized that, gosh, every time my stomach hurts, when I go out, and I'm talking like, you know, many, many, many decades ago, you know, every time my stomach hurts, when I chew this one particular leaf from this one particular plant, my stomach feels so much better. And scientists realized, well, gosh, you don't have to eat the plant, the leaves of that plant. We can isolate the very specific chemical compound from that plant that was providing you that therapeutic benefit. And now we can just give it to you in pill format. We can give you the actual chemical drug. And that was kind of the first wave of modern medicine, is realizing that we can just isolate the active compound and give that to you as a medicine. And this is the vast majority of all drugs every one of us has ever taken throughout our lives. And more recently, there's been kind of a shift into what I kind of call the second wave of modern medicine, which is basically making protein versions of drugs. And why is that? And where did that come from? So when you take those chemical drugs, like all the pills that you get from the pharmacy, the way they work, the mechanism of action, right? You're going to swallow that thing, that chemical, it's going to get broken down in the acids in your stomach, and it's going to get released into the blood supply in your GI tract. And then it's going to go find its cognate receptor in your body, and that receptor is a protein, and either it acts directly on that protein at the cell surface, or it goes inside of the cell and it affects some change on a protein inside your cell. It causes that protein to like alter its particular shape or its function or who it talked to or who it signals to. And so the end result is a change in a protein, even though you took a chemical drug. And so the kind of second wave of modern medicine was realizing, well, gosh, what if we just cut out the middleman and we didn't give you the chemical drug, we just gave you the protein version of the drug that already had that modification to it. And this is an anecdote that I told at the All In Summit, the most successful drug of all time, Humira. This is an antibody that gets used in rheumatoid arthritis. They sell about $21, $22 billion worth of this drug every single year. And it has been the most successful drug for like the last 20 years. So this is like the ultimate reign. You know, this is not something that regularly happens. And that was a big shift in our thinking. Realized that you could just deliver proteins as a medicine. But then even then, right, that is only something that is kind of dictated by kind of, you know, fundamental structure, function, relationships in biology around these proteins, these types of things. But what if you want something that's even more dynamic than that, right? So then now we fast forward to kind of like the bleeding edge, like right now in modern medicine, which is where the third wave is coming. And that's what we call living medicines. That's where we give you things like viruses and cells. And those are actually going in and kind of like participating with your body in doing the therapeutic, and in some cases, you know, becoming part of your body. If it's a cell therapy, in some of these cases, these therapies might be with you forever. And so using viruses and cells as now a way to modulate, you know, cell signaling and cell expression, and doing kind of therapeutic things of interest. They do many, many things, so it's hard to kind of categorize them in a really small, tight bucket. But using living medicines that are very good at getting inside of you to affect changes that would be useful therapeutically, either in the short term or permanently, so whether it's for acute diseases or chronic diseases. And that's kind of the current bleeding edge and the space that I work in, which is these living medicines, and more specifically, viral gene therapy. So using viruses as medicines themselves, which is also kind of a weird thing. A lot of folks haven't necessarily heard of that concept. You're like, wait, no, viruses make you sick. That's what viruses do. And it's like, no. Actually, the vast majority of viruses that have ever been discovered don't make humans sick. We only know the 20 or 25 or so really, really well. You know, if you ask folks on the street, name a virus, I guarantee you they're going to name what we call a pathogenic virus, a virus that is a pathogen, a virus that causes a disease. But the vast majority of viruses, all the stuff that's like on your skin, everywhere, right? They're not pathogenic viruses. The vast majority of them are still very good at getting inside of you. They're infectious. So a very commonly misused word. Infectious just means like the ability to get inside of you. Doesn't necessarily mean it's disease causing. That's pathogenic. But we can use these viruses that are very good at getting inside of you to deliver medicines, whatever kind of medicine we want. And so it's kind of using all of the term that we use in science is called biomimicry, right? You mimic all of the things that nature has already figured out over eons and eons and eons. And now you leverage that and use that in the scientific setting to do something therapeutically and medicinally. So yeah, using viruses as medicine.
Wonderful. That's a great primer. And if we look at Ozempic, because I know that everyone kind of talks about Ozempic. So if I understand correctly, is that like a first type drug? Is it like a molecule or is it like an antibody?
So it depends. There's different classes of these types of drugs. You can have a chemical version, you can have a protein version. But no matter what, it's not a living medicine. It's not that third category where it's like a cell or a virus or a bacteriophage or something like this. And yet it's projected to upseat Humira. Humira is still the best-selling drug of all time. But I think if you give it a couple single-digit years, the projections are all that this class of drugs, these weight loss drugs, are supposed to be the biggest blockbuster drugs of all time. And then who upseats them? You know, TBD. But they are projected to be very big blockbusters.
If we look at this first two categories, what I kind of find fascinating is that in both categories, you're kind of treating your whole body. This medicine comes into your whole body and then it's up to have the receptors or for you to get that protein and for the protein to work in the way that you want it. Whereas like with the gene therapy or cell therapy, when you use the viruses, you can just go very, very precise. Would you like to tell us a little bit of like, how does that work? How can you use a virus? Can you give us some examples?
So one of the ways you can do this, and this is obviously like a multi-layered approach. But one of the easiest, most simple ways to do this at its fundamental core, let's take, for example, you've got some type of lung disorder that you want to treat. It's only in your lungs, not in your brain, it's not in your kidneys, it's not in your bladder, it's not in your fingernails, right? It's only in your lungs. We can go out and look through our like Rolodex of nature and find viruses that already only go to your lungs, right? You've probably experienced some of these, right? When you think of a cold virus, right? It goes into your nasopharyngeal tract and your lungs. But when you get a cold, right? Your feet don't hurt, you know, your bladder doesn't hurt, right? It's only your lungs where you feel that pressure and all of those things, because that's where that virus goes, right? So we can take viruses that already, without any engineering at all, just like Mother Nature's design, we can go out and we can find viruses that already go to either the exact place we want or like more or less where we want. And then we can further restrict it through some fun scientific engineering. But you can pick a virus that already mostly goes to where you want. You can remove out, take out everything that you don't want it to have, and then you can put in whatever you do want it to have. And now it just becomes like a little FedEx truck. And the payload, the medicine, is quite literally the little package. And you're like, yeah, just go to the lung where you were already going and just deliver and drop off the package. And so now you could treat a lung disorder like cystic fibrosis, a lung tumor that's only in the lungs and not in some other tissue. So that's like baseline. A first thing you can do is just pick a virus that already kind of goes where you want it to go. And there are viruses that go to just about every single place in your body you could possibly imagine, both individually, like I only go to the lung, or in combinations. There are viruses that go to the heart and the lung, but not anywhere else, right? So combinations of twos and threes and, you know, the infinite universe, there are many, many, many viruses. So you can really kind of pick and choose from these. And that's kind of a first thing you can do. And then you can start adding all of the fun scientific engineering and synthetic biology to that, where you can start tagging the viruses with things, removing things from the viruses, adding functionalities in the lab to get them to be even more specific, where you're like, I don't want you to just go to the lung. I want you to only go to cells in the lung that are expressing this particular thing on their cell surface. They're going to have this particular chemical flag. And I only want you to touch and interact and bind and enter the cells that have that particular chemical flag. And in virology in general and in gene therapy. And so this is something something we've been doing for quite a while. And you can start to layer these things. You can layer something where you remove something from the virus. You're going to add one or two things to it as well. You can change things at the genomic level, at the payload, right? The genome that it's carrying, and say like, okay, well, I only want, after you find that cell in the lung that's only expressing that very special chemical flag and you go inside of it, I only want you to express your genome if that cell has this particular feature. So you can do like these feature finding things. You can do Boolean logic, like if and or. You can engineer in these expression circuits that are very analogous to the way we do this in coding. It's quite literally the same, only instead of, you know, the alphabet that we've got on our keyboard, we've got four things, A's, T's, G's, and C's. Those are the keystrokes that we can touch in the genome. And you can combine all of these things on to make, basically create like this multi-layered way of adding more and more control so that you can get more and more precise delivery of whatever the type of drug is that you want to deliver to where you want. It's not perfect yet. We by no means have this like down to a perfect art and everything is ready for prime time, but it is definitely far beyond where we were 10 or 20 years ago. And we can really start to get, you know, some pretty precise targeting.
What's the execution program, if you will? It's the same language, but why would they listen to the new virus? What tells them, okay, go, you need to change, you need to adapt?
Yeah, so really now this depends on what kind of gene therapy we're doing. And there's kind of two broad classes. There's always edge cases, but we can like ignore edge cases. The two main things that we do with gene therapy with viruses, we're either doing what's called gene transfer gene therapy, where we're literally, like it says, we're transferring you a copy of a gene you don't have. So either you were born literally missing an entire gene, like a portion of one of your chromosomes was just gone, or you had the gene, but it had a really critical mutation such that it wasn't able to work, right? So you were born with a genetic disorder. You had no ability to make the protein that comes from that gene. And what we do with viral gene transfer gene therapy is we're just going to give you a whole extra copy of it. So whether you were missing it or you had a mutation in it, we're just going to give you a copy of it. And now your body knows it can actually bind to, and there's like little signaling receptors and things that you can kind of engineer into the genome that says like, hey, bind here and read through me and make the thing that I'm encoding. You know, it's kind of like if you read a book, right, there might be an introduction chapter that kind of sets the stage for the story. You can kind of build those into the genome as well. Like a little like, hey, bind here and then tell the little polymerase, the little enzyme that's going to read through the DNA. Be like, start right here and then read through this thing and then make the thing that I'm describing. In that way, you can basically tell them, just make this thing that I'm carrying and it will benefit you. And very often you can experience this phenomenon called positive selective pressure, where if a cell desperately needed a thing and didn't have it, like a functional gene that was really important for life, and then you provide it, those cells will have a huge advantage in that local environment and they can actually grow and expand. And so that's like a really common phenomenon. So that cell will actually have an advantage relative to its neighbors. And the other thing that you can do with viruses, the other kind of big class of viral gene therapy, is gene editing, where we actually go in and we use a virus and we tell it, go in and we're actually going to fix the mutation. So rather than give you a whole extra copy of a good version of the gene that you had a mutation in, we're just going to fix the mutation in sight. We're going to go in, make a little snip, cut out the bad part, put in the exact sequence that was supposed to be there, right? So that's one form of gene editing. There's also ones where you don't cut the genome, but you modify. There's these little chemical flags that can live on your DNA that can quiet things down or amp them up. And sometimes you want them to be amped up, and so we can do that. Or sometimes you want them to be really quiet, and so we can tamp them down. And so there's different ways you can use things like base editing and prime editing and these types of things to alter the little chemical flags that exist on DNA. Or we could go in and just cut the DNA itself and either give you a whole new copy of a gene in the exact site it's supposed to be, or we can fix the individual teeny tiny mutation, the little keystroke in site, and then now you've got this permanent fix that's actually inside your genome. So those are kind of the two big classes, gene transfer and gene editing. But it wouldn't be heritable. So that's kind of another thing to make sure folks understand that unless you make that change in sperm and eggs, right, then it wouldn't be heritable to the next generation. If you're making this change in like the skin of your shoulder, right, that's only going to be for you because the skin in your shoulder is not heritable, only the genetics passed on between sperm and eggs. So all gene editing that has been done in humans to date has been the non-heritable kind. We will probably get to a point in the future where we are doing heritable gene therapy and gene editing, where we're making permanent changes to sperm and eggs. But ethically, we're not there as a society yet. So that's something we're not yet doing.
And what is the status of gene therapy today? As you mentioned, this is like at the edge of modern medicine. What is possible today? What is already approved? What is in the market? And maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, what you guys are doing and where in the process are you guys?
Yeah. So I think most folks would be surprised to hear that there are even viral gene therapies and cell therapies are approved. A lot of folks, unless you have those diseases, may not have like percolated down to the 5 o'clock news that, you know, that you heard. But there are many, you know, many like dozens. I think, you know, we're up to like 23 or 24, at least in the United States, you know, gene and cell therapy products that treat things like blood clotting disorders, that treat things like inherited blindness, that treat different forms of cancer and these types of things. And this is just the start. So right now it's like 1 to 2 to 3 approvals a year if you combine both the cell therapies and the viral gene therapies. If we just look at the viral space, it's been about 1 approval per year over the last several years. So we're up to like 5 or 6 or so now. But there's a very famous prospectus that gets put out every year by Wells Fargo around kind of the state of the market across a variety of different sectors. And they do one for viral gene therapy. And there's just this wave of hundreds and hundreds of gene therapies that are anywhere from like phase 1, phase 2 trials, so a little bit earlier, or those phase 3 trials, which are a little bit later, because right, you have 3 phase trials until you hit the market, right? A phase 1, a phase 2, and a phase 3. And then if your phase 3 works, then you go up and you ask the FDA, hey, can we sell this drug on the market? And so there's just hundreds of in kind of the phase 1, 2, and 3 pipeline. And so within the next single digit years, there will not just be 5 viral gene therapies. There will be at least dozens, possibly hundreds, depending on how many years we're talking. And so it's remarkable. And these are to treat things that are becoming much, much, much more common. So things like problems around hearing, things with vision, things with like congestive heart failure, diabetes, right? Things that are much more common than some of these very, very rare things that we started with. And so, right, the classic line that I always say, and I genuinely believe it, is you will receive a viral gene therapy in your lifetime.
Wow, this is wonderful. This is exciting. And I know that you guys have quite a novel approach and you try to detect cancer. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so we're a weird edge case. So we are neither of those two things that I just mentioned, either a gene edit or a gene transfer gene therapy. And not only are we neither of those two things, we're trying to do something a little bit crazy. We're trying to make the world's first universal viral gene therapy, which means it can be used to treat more than one thing. So every single viral gene therapy on the planet in development right now is specific for a single indication, right? It can only be used to treat one disease, hemophilia B, Leber's congenital amaurosis, you know, you name it. But it can't be used to treat 2 things, much less 20 things or 200 things or 2,000 things. And so we're trying to make a class, basically a platform of viruses that by its very nature can be used to treat more than one thing. So that's kind of like one of our hallmarks that sets us apart, is that we will only work on gene therapies that can be used to treat more than one thing. We only want to work on things that are universal. Doesn't mean it could treat every disease on the planet. That's insane. But they have to be able to be used to treat more than one indication so that we can start to scale this stuff. You know, the single digit approvals we've had so far in the field have been momentous and amazing. And the first steps are always the hardest and the most expensive. But when I say expensive, I mean expensive, right? So there's like the cost to produce those chemical drugs, and then there's the cost to produce those living medicines. And because they're so new, you know, these regularly top at $2 to $3 billion per drug. And so these prices will come down with time, but you know, it's early days, so they cost a lot of money. And they're usually like 10 to 15 years per indication. And so if you could treat 10 diseases with one virus rather than one disease with one virus, like now you can start to leverage the learnings from that first program into the second program, and it won't be 15 years and $3 billion for that program. Maybe it'll be 6 years and $900 million, right? So still not cheap, but, you know, categorically a different amount of capital. And, you know, and that's your second program. And maybe your third program is 5 years and now it's $500 million. And you can start to make these things much more cost-effective and effective, you know, timeline-wise as far as clinical development, so that we can get more things to patients more quickly. And so we're trying to make the first of this particular class of virus that we work on. It's called AAV, or adeno-associated virus. Specifics don't matter, but it's a very special virus that I'm quite fond of. And it's the main virus that we use to perform gene therapy in the field. Something like 80% of all viral gene therapy trials use this virus. So we're going to make the first one that's ever been used in cancer before. This virus has never been used to treat any cancer in any tissue in any humans in any country of the world. And also, there's never been a universal version that can be used to treat more than one thing before. So we're going to make the world's first oncology AAV virus, or we're going to make the world's first universal version that can be used to treat many things. And so that's a big ask, and one that my academic labs, I was a professor before this, one that my academic labs spent many, 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 many years on before we got up the gumption to spin out a company. But, you know, if you're going to do something, go big or go home. So I'm going to give it a try.
What was the motivation behind it? What's the background story? It kind of seems that you're tackling something so hard and so challenging. Where is this coming from?
Yeah, so what's our X-Men origin story here? So this all began when I was still faculty at UCSF here in San Francisco in California. And, you know, my lab was fairly unique. We were a gene therapy lab that didn't work on gene therapies, meaning we didn't work on particular drugs for a particular indication and a particular tissue, these types of things. We worked at the platform level itself and just tried to develop enabling technologies that would make any viral gene therapy like cheaper, easier, and faster so we could go after more indications more quickly and help more patients. So whether that meant like engineering novel capsids, that's that outer protein shell that the virus has, that little like icosahedron you always see in the pictures. So you can actually engineer those to have different specificities, to engineering the genomic components that drive the expression in the genome, to engineering the synthetic circuits we were talking about, to the ways you manufacture the virus and purify it, and the way you dose it and applying big omics, right? All the big data that we talk about in the biotech space. So genomics, epigenomics, proteomics, all these big omics, right? Applying those to the fundamental biology of the virus and seeing if we could learn something really interesting that we could leverage in a cool way out in industry. But we didn't work on individual gene therapies. And so we wanted to come up with, you know, we were kind of whiteboarding out in the earliest days of my group, like, what are the challenges that are going to have to be solved from within academia? Because they're going to take way too long and they're going to be so high risk that like no one out in industry is going to bankroll this with venture capital dollars, these types of things, right? There are VC fundable ideas and there are non-VC fundable ideas. And so we wanted to work on the things that wouldn't be VC fundable that would like change the absolute needle of global health. And so one of the things we came up with was the fact that gene therapies don't scale. Like I said, every gene therapy on the planet is one for one. It can only be used to treat one indication. And so even if you're a specialist company and you only treat skeletal muscle gene therapy disorders with your company, and you're like, aha, we will be specialists. And because we only treat skeletal muscle disorders, you know, we don't have to learn about all these other tissues and other routes of administration and all these things. We're going to specialize and that's going to help us be faster. But that doesn't really work out and pan out that way. If you are a skeletal muscle gene therapy company and you only treat skeletal muscle disorders, I promise you, you know, like all of your different program teams, your Duchenne's team doesn't talk to your limb muscle girdle team, doesn't talk to your spinal muscular atrophy team, doesn't talk to your Pompe team. You know, these are all skeletal muscle genetic disorders. It's because these programs are often started apart in time by 2 to 3 years because it costs so much capital to start a new program. And you usually go out and raise like a whole new like $250 million round to in-license a program from some big academic lab where you develop it in-house either way. And since your last program started, it's been 2 or 3 years and there's a new best thing. Of all the things that you need to incorporate into that virus, there's a new best outer protein shell, that capsid. There's a new best, all the genomic components that go into building that genome. There's a new best one of each of those. And you don't want to get caught saying in your pitch deck that you're using like, you know, 5-year-old technology. You want to say you're using the super, super, super newest cutting edge stuff. And so every one of your programs gets built from scratch with completely new stuff. And it's the equivalent of being like a car company where you have 2 or 3 different cars that your company makes. And there's not one bolt that is shared across all of those cars. Like that's the state of kind of the viral gene therapy space. And it's just like, this isn't going to scale. Like we have got to come up with a gene therapy that has component parts that can be used across programs and can be used to treat more than one thing. And so we kind of took a step back and wanted to just ask a really audacious question. Like, would it be possible to make a universal gene therapy? Like what would that entail? What would that be like? And then we just went down the rabbit hole for the better part of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. And fast forward at the end of that, Siren came out. So it was really just around trying to come up with technologies that would help gene therapy scale.
So where are you today?
So we spun out about 2 years ago from UCSF and we went really far. We moved across the street into a faculty incubator, like literally like 50 feet, like across the street. I can like see my old lab from my current office and raised some proper funds from Founders Fund and Lux. So some pretty marquee partners and we're really stoked to have them. And we're out raising our Series A right now. So holler if any of y'all find this interesting. But, you know, we've got kind of our platform set up now. We spent the first two years kind of in stealth. We knew that there were going to be a lot of fast follows since this was going to be a pretty big first, right? The first AAV gene therapy in oncology and the first universal gene therapy. So we knew the minute we came out of stealth, there would be some fast follows. So we've spent kind of the first 2 years being really stealth and building out the platform and coming up with our lead asset that we're really pumped about. And now it's just to see if this thing has legs.
How much are you fundraising and what are all the milestones?
So we're out trying to raise something between like 30 and 40 million, which is enough to basically get you through all of your what are called IND enabling animal experiments. So it's all of the things you have to do to prove to the FDA to let you run your phase 1 trial. So you make really, really pure virus like clinical purity grade, the virus that goes in humans, and then you test it again in animals. So we've already tested it in something like 500 animals. It works amazing, but you need to retest it one more time with now your super duper duper clinical pure virus and show that like, yes, okay, it still works with this exact lot that's super, super pure. And then you take this massive data packet and you submit it to the FDA in this thing called an IND, an investigational new drug application. And you say like, okay, take a look at this. Let me see if you agree. And then if they give it the thumbs up, then you can start enrolling in your clinical trial and bringing patients on. So we get up to the moment the trial starts. and then we would need to raise the Series B.
Fingers crossed.
I don't know what the FDA is going to say. So TV. That's the plan.
Yeah. So what's your dream with Siren?
Oh my goodness. The dream with Siren is that it's that our kind of, we haven't named publicly our development candidate yet, but our lead asset, the one that we're most excited about, the hope is that it and some of its brethren that we're cooking as well will not only work with like the vision, right, that they're universal and they can be used to treat more than one thing, but the hope is that we can use them not only as monotherapies, and just like it sounds, that means use it on its own, but often in the cancer world, right, the things that work best are when we start making combination therapies. So I take your best drug and my best drug and this other best drug that have different mechanisms of action, and if we use them all at once against a cancer, now there's no way for it to evolve an escape mechanism. Right? And so you want things that are broad spectrum, like ours is. It's an immunomodulator. It modulates your immune system to attack your tumor yourself. And then you combine that with things that are really, really specific, that go after only tumors that have this exact mutation and these types of things. And so you can start to combine these things. So our hope is that we can also become a combination therapy that's really effective, particularly for patients where this particular class of drugs called PD-1 or PD-L1. So things like pembrolizumab, Keytruda, where patients aren't responsive to those kind of classes of drugs, where we could maybe be an alternative to that. So we could work both in the monotherapy and in the combination therapy setting and just start going down the list and just start going after as many cancers as possible and really make a dent on this stuff. And that's a massive dream.
I really hope that you will succeed. I mean, this is just such a big benefit to humanity. And are you really going after all types of cancers, or do you start with one?
Well, you always start with one. You can't run like 10 trials at once. No one will give you that much money, right? Like Novartis and Pfizer, like the big boys, they can run 10 trials at once. But when you're a startup, especially if it's what's called a first-in-human drug, which means it's never been tested in a human before. So even though our virus has been used in tens of thousands of patients before, right? Like the class of virus to do normal gene transfer gene therapy, that first category I mentioned, it's never been used to treat a cancer before. And so it's still going to be a first in human drug in that particular use case in that setting. And so when you're venture backed, right, they don't want to give you, you know, $500 million as your seed round, right? They give you like $6 million. And they're like, see what you can do with that. See if you can't get to a de-risking milestone where maybe we would give you a little bit more. And so once you start to show that this thing has legs and it works in patients, then you go out and you raise the mega round and bring in the kind of later stage, like private equity and bigger round folks, or you just skip that round entirely and you go right to the market and you IPO, and then you can run 10 things at once. But in the beginning, it's one at a time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, which cancer are you going first?
So we haven't named that publicly yet, this specific cancer, but we're really interested in brain cancers to start with, because all brain cancers, there's about 126 of them, all brain cancers by definition are considered rare. So it's fewer than 200,000 patients in the US per year. And what that means is that every one of the cancers in the brain is eligible for what's called orphan designation. And if you're orphan designation, then you can apply for that accelerated approval that I was talking about, where you can skip that phase 3 trial and you can just do that single combined phase 1-2 trial and have a much faster development time. And so we're really excited about the brain as kind of a platform tissue to get started with. There's all kinds of other scientific reasons that the brain is a really fun place to start. We're kind of seeing if this thing has legs. So we're starting in the brain.
Just to change gears a little bit and let's get personal. Entrepreneurship is a roller coaster. How do you relax?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. 2023 and 2022 were, you know, special years. I am a woman of two spirits. I am simultaneously like the biggest tomboy ever. And my way of relaxing is just being outside and doing stuff. I don't care what the stuff is. I don't care if it's mountain biking, road biking, snowboarding, wakeboarding. I don't care if it's like whitewater rafting. I don't care what it is. I just want to be outside. I want to get dirty and I want to do stuff and I want an adrenaline rush. And I'm super competitive. So if we can like make it a competition, even better. It's like, that's one, you know, that's the little devil on my shoulder. And then the little angel is, I'm a little spa girl and I do love me some spa things. And so like once a week I go get acupuncture. Once a week I go do sauna and cold plunge. Once a week I go get either a deep tissue or a Swedish massage. So like literally every 2 to 3 days, you go find me in the spa. And then on the other days, I'm out like, you know, whitewater rafting or something. So I have two beings at once in conflict. A girly girl and a toddler. But that's how you survive.
It's a balance though. I do remember actually during the All-In Summit that you said that if you had had the chance, you would choose to only sleep 4 hours.
Aha, the sleep mutation.
Exactly. So I'm kind of curious, like what would you do with the rest of the time? And also you mentioned that actually this is possible today with gene therapy.
Yeah, I can give a one sentence explanation of this for folks who didn't catch the All-In Summit. If you didn't, just Google All-In Summit, Nicole Polk, you can find it. So there is a mutation that's naturally occurring in humans to this gene, this one gene called DEC2, like the three letters DEC and then the number 2. And this gene actually controls this level of a hormone that you make called orexin. And this hormone is very important and involved in maintaining wakefulness. And so if you have a particular mutation in like one keystroke, one spot in that gene in your genome, you only need to sleep 4 hours to be completely rested, whereas the rest of us need 8. And they're completely fine. Like no other part of their physiology is affected by this mutation. They just don't need to sleep as long to be completely rested. So I always love bringing that up as like a fun example of things that like, we know this today. You could make a gene therapy for this tomorrow. No one's doing it yet, but you could. And this would be a gene editing gene therapy and then potentially make that edit. And then you would only need 4 hours of sleep. What would I do if I had 4 more hours a day? The honest answer, I would probably work.
I thought that you would say that.
In my much more like thinking bigger and trying to sound more amazing, you know, then I would try to do more of the outdoor stuff. Do a little bit more mountain biking or whitewater rafting or snowboarding or just be outside, especially when you're here on the West Coast in the US, where it's just so beautiful. And that's the big difference between the West Coast and the East Coast. We always say West Coast, best coast, right? East Coast, what'd you buy this weekend? West Coast, it's what'd you summit this weekend, right? So that's the way we brag to each other. So I would want to summit more things.
I like that. Tell me about a moment you struggled in your career. I mean, from the outside, it seems that you had this perfect career. You were in academia, you were a founder. Now everything is going perfectly. You have this novel approach. Tell me about a moment where maybe things were not going that great.
Yeah. So I'd say two kind of examples that are easy to bring up. One was around the decision to leave academia. That was a like heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching, like hours spent, you know, like during, this was, we spun out during the peak of COVID. Like when I say peak of COVID, like remember the beginning when you were still like Lysoling your food because you were scared to open the bag because maybe there was virus on the bag of chips or something. When we were still all locked in and we weren't allowed to go back to work yet and stay 6 feet apart and wear a mask and these types of things. You know, we're a 100% wet lab. So like, we were banned from campus. I am a virology professor at the time, and we were banned from campus. I'm like, we wear masks and booties and hairnets and all the things like 365 days a year. Like, we got this. This is only a BSL-2 virus. It's not even that dangerous. But yet, right, we were banned from campus. And so it's like, you know, 9 months staring at your ceiling in your bedroom and being like, oh my God, like there has to be a better way. You know, what am I going to do? Am I going to reinvent myself? Am I going to spin out this company that we've kind of been thinking about? Am I going to do this? Right. And that was a really hard, like when you thought you made it and you got your, what you thought was your dream job, what would it take to convince you that you were wrong and that there might actually be a different other dream job? And that, you know, now was a moment to completely and utterly reinvent yourself. And even though it's not true in academia, they feed you this Kool-Aid that tells you that like, if you go to the other side, you can never come back. Right. And so it's very hard to go against that headwind from your colleagues and from the field. And so the angst around making that decision of like, am I really going to quit and not just like take a leave? Like I am going to resign fully and, you know, optically show everyone like I am 100% committed to this. That was a really hard time, like personally, to get to that place where I felt like, yes, I am making the right decision. And then honestly, like last year, any founder who was out fundraising last year, right, you can kind of see my grays that are starting to come in right here. Those are from 2023. Those are from fundraising and like the SVB crash and like coming up with like, just accept the fact that like no VC is going to get like last year, no VC is going to give you money. Now what, right? Like, what are you going to do? And like in our space here in Silicon Valley, it's just like, we accept VC dollars and that is all that we do because VCs are who fund early stage startups. And it's just like, well, I know a whole nother world because I came from academia. And I was like, gosh, there's a lot of grants out there. And I know this world. I'm basically a professionally trained grant writer coming from being a professor. And so realizing that like in about like mid-year last year in June, realizing like, you know what? VCs are just not going to write a check this year. They just aren't. They're spooked. The market's all crazy. And so just like deciding whole hog that we are going to pivot, not in our science, not in our technology, not in our approach, but in how we're going to fundraise. And so we just completely stopped VC fundraising mid last year and pivoted entirely to grants and went all in. And we were submitting, you know, grants, these large grants tend to be like 150 to 250 pages each. And we were submitting one every 2.5 weeks. And, you know, it paid off. We've got an initial $4 million grant that's got an additional $27 million in follow-on funds. This is all non-dilutive. We've got another like 16 grants that are about to read out here in the next like single digit weeks. This is like a real amount of money. This is the amount of money that's like around. So just realizing and getting to the place where it's like, we're going to take a different path because it's the only path that there is, quite frankly. And just kind of being willing to come to grips with that, even though historically, you know, your VCs would have been like, do not write grants. Do not waste your time doing this. If you need money, come talk to me. But that wasn't true in 2022 and 2023. And so having to kind of reinvent your brain, kind of your mental space around how are we going to fund this?
Congrats. I mean, congrats for pushing through, for going through this. And actually, it might turn out that actually this was the best case scenario because you having given up your equity.
Exactly. I mean, non-dilutive is just the best money. Exactly. I love all my VC friends. Hearts out to all of you, but non-dilutive is even better.
And last question, if Nicole from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell her?
Well, first, I'd probably just be like, girl, you have no idea what's coming. You're going to get your dream job and then you're going to give it up. And, you know, and that version of me would be like, you're crazy. There's no way. So I'd probably spend most of that time talking with that other version of me about just being, I know I'm dead serious. Like there's some crazy stuff that's about to happen. And just getting her to a place where she's like, okay, I don't know if I believe you, but this is wild. Okay. So I'd probably mostly just be like, you know, trying to get her to believe me. She just wouldn't possibly, right? The classic line, you always massively overestimate what you can accomplish in 1 year, but massively underestimate what you can accomplish in 10. I just wholeheartedly agree. I think 10 years ago, me, which 10 years ago, that'd be 2014. So I would be right smack in the middle of my PhD. I hadn't even done my postdoc yet. Oh my gosh. Like the field of gene therapy wasn't even a thing yet. That was still back when, you know, single digit patients had been treated. We would go to the big annual meeting and there'd be like 30 of us sitting around in jeans, eating pizza and like cracking beers, you know, in someone's classroom versus now you go to our big gene therapy meeting and there's literally tens of thousands of people, you know, in suits. And we're all talking about, you know, our big, huge phase 3 clinical trials and the billion-dollar drugs we've created. And that all happened in 10 years, right? The entire field like went from nothing to completely existing in that span of time. So I think 10 years ago, me would have just not even believed that was possible, much less that like I would be a key opinion leader and subject matter expert in the space. I would have never believed it.
Well, I'm very happy that you put all your energy, and it seems that you have a lot, in actually solving a very, very tough problem. And also, I can't picture you with your energy within academia. But thank you so much for taking the time and sharing the story with us and also what's new in gene therapy. I wish you all the best and good luck. Hopefully, the VC market is going to open up in 2024, and hopefully some VCs listening to the pod will reach out.
So too. That was great. Really nice talking to you.